Welcome to Walking in Faith, featuring interviews and reviews that help you rediscover the Catholic faith in our culture. And now here is your host, Barbara Schenkel.
Welcome to Walking in Faith. This morning we have two interviews for you. First up is Marcus Grodi. He's written the book Life from Our Land. And then following that, we have an interview with Robert Royal. He's written the book A Deeper Vision, The Catholic Intellectual Tradition. So we'll bring you those interviews right now. Good morning. This morning we're speaking with Marcus Grodi. He's the author of a new book called Life from Our Land. Welcome, Marcus.
Good morning.
So many of our listeners are aware of the work you do on the Coming Home Network, and it's a great pleasure and honor to have you on the show to talk about this book, Life from Our Land. Who would have ever thought of you as a country farmer? Tell us the reason he wrote this book.
Yeah, that's a good statement, because I think a lot of people don't either think of me as that, and actually I don't think I would have ever thought of myself doing that either, because that was hardly anything that I experienced growing up. I was not brought up out in the country. I was brought up in a suburb of Toledo, about as far from farming as close as I got to farming was the vegetables at the grocery store.
And one of the things I love about this book, you talk about your experiences, you know, inheriting some of the land from your wife's grandfather and embarking on this great journey with great ambitions. But what really comes through this book when you read it is, you know, the argument that, you know, we have so much clutter in our lives right now. There's so much noise that when you actually get apart from it all, you get to reflect. I think this book is a great sense of your reflections about how God permeates his creation in everything. Talk a little bit about that inspiration.
Yeah, thank you for that. And let me begin by, as I did in the book, that this book is not about farming. It's not even a call to that. There are hundreds of books out there today, and have been in the 20th century particularly, about escaping from the city and going to the country, sustainable farming, getting off the grid. There are lots of books about that, and I can't deny that some of that has been a part of our thinking over the last 20 years, but that's not what this book is about. And, you know, if a person visited our farm, they could go down the gravel road and find hundreds of other people that are much more worthy of writing books about farming. What this book, for me, was about, as you just said, when we left the clutter of the city to go out to the country, to the place where my wife had inherited this land. Our original intent was, I actually designed a house, had it built, moved in, living out in the woods. And it was beginning the idea of a retreat, but we were going to be near her family. But as we moved out, we began thinking about being a better steward of this land we were given. We asked, well, what is this land for? Why has God called us out here? And we have tried all kinds of aspects of farming. I've raised sheep and cattle and at Jersey, dairy cows and pigs, chickens. And I've made cheese and slaughtered lambs and given birth to calves and all that experience. But in the process of it, what I reflected on the book is how that experience opened our eyes to what many have called God's other book. And when we think about the Word of God, we think about how his revelation has come to us through the church, through tradition, but particularly through Scripture. But there's another book through which God tries to communicate to us his love and mercy and care, and that's his creation. And Scripture tells us about that in the first chapter of Romans. It talks about the very evidence of God is there, if we'll see it. And St. Bonaventure, in his wonderful book, Journey of the Mind to God, talks about the first step in our journey to God begins with recognizing his vestiges, the evidence of his fingerprint, creation around us. And basically what I'm saying in the book is it took leaving the city for me to go out to the country to discover what was there all along that I've seen all my life. And my point in the book is to say, actually, you don't need to leave the city to do that. It's maybe more difficult in the city. But what it is that wherever God has called you to live and be, encouragement is to look at that second book, to open your eyes and, as they used to. I mean, so often today with all the clutter and the pressure of our lives in the city, how many of us take the time to just go outside at night and look at the stars the way David did and recognize that it's evidence of God's love and creation, trees, the birds? You know, often we belittle that. You know, we belittle people that are looking at the trees or listening to the birds or looking at the butterflies. But the call that I saw was that they open our minds up to God's constant presence, his constant voice, trying to remind us that we've been put here for a purpose, that we're surrounded by his love and his care. It's all there for us to see. It's just that modern technology, this whole fast-moving pace life, distracts us from that. And we get detached from God when, in fact, we need to be detached from this stuff so we can be more open to his constant care in our life.
And it really is a romance, isn't it, in terms of what God has created, in terms of our appreciation of it, and how important is it for us, as you mentioned, getting out, just observing his creation, but also just giving him thanks for such great magnificence, artistry. And then I want you to talk a little bit about the birds and how that relates to God's love for us.
Yes. I will say I didn't hear you very well in that one. I'm sorry. I didn't have a very good connection.
Okay. You know what? Let me do that one again. Let me ask it again.
Yeah. Let me move a little bit.
For some reason, I tend to put the mic down when someone else is talking, so my and all my other things aren't picked up on the mic. But when I put the mic back up to ask the question, it just didn't connect. So can you hear this better? Is this better?
Yeah, it sounds just a little garbled.
Oh.
Just a little.
Okay. Is this better?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay,
that's better.
Great.
Yeah.
So I was, okay. Isn't this really a romance that God has with us in his creation? And you mentioned the importance of going out in nature just to appreciate it. But how important is it also for us to thank God for his great artistry and magnificence?
Yeah, I truly believe that is the key attitude. I mean, it's the old cliche, the attitude of gratitude. But I truly believe that's the key. We're surrounded by people that in our culture today, you might call them the Mother Earth News folk. There's a lot of people there that are calling us to be environmentalists, to get back to the land, to take care of the creation. Well, they won't use it. They'll say take care of nature, take care of the world. And they're very much materialists. And I think they're missing the point. And the point is that when you see the beauty of a bird and you just meditate on it, the key is that should draw our mind and heart and attitude to God in gratitude and thanksgiving for the gift of this world that he's given us. It's a temporary place for us because we're really on a pilgrimage to our true home, which is with God in heaven. That's the journey through this world. But in the meantime, he's given us this wonderful place to enjoy his care. And I believe that's truly appreciated. We shouldn't merely look at the world around us through utilitarian eyes. You know, I have 25 acres. Do I only look at that land and what can I use it to make money? How can I make money from it? And the problem is we get caught up in this utilitarian attitude and we begin to look at you know, how can these people be a benefit to our culture? You know, how can our kids go out and get a good education so they can make money? What is their make? And we look through everything through an industrialist, utilitarian, materialist perspective. And in the process, I believe we miss the ultimate purpose for why we were created, why this world was given to us as our temporary home on our journey through the kingdom. And so when we, if we, like I use in the book, to me, which is an amazing aspect of creation, that the materialists cannot explain, and that is the calls of a bird. We take it for granted, but the I think someone's calling. I apologize. That people may show up. Scientists can use natural selection to describe why certain animals maybe have developed certain characteristics. But when you look at a particular bird, a robin or a blue jay or a catbird, every catbird looks exactly the same. Every robin looks exactly the same. We can describe that through natural selection. But why do they have the same call? Every robin in the world has the same call. Every blue jay has the same call. Where did they learn that? How do they have that? And to me, it should draw us to gratitude from God giving us the gift of this wonderful creature for us to enjoy. Rather than always trying to come up with some utilitarian explanation of why it happened, look at it as a gift. The beauty of this world, and the point is, it should draw us forward. And of course, I also talk a lot in the book about our need to be detached from stuff. And, because we get drawn into this culture of more stuff.
You know, you talk about analogies of faith, really, when you're looking at your farm and creation. And one of the things that I thought was interesting is that you don't shy away from your failures on the farm, or your sense that, hey, I did it once, I cleared the field, and now I'm done, and I'm good. And most people think of their faith that way, I think. They think that maybe now that they've gone through this, you know, their sacraments at a certain age, their faith is done. You point out how erroneous that is, that you always have to keep plowing the field and keeping the weeds away. And it's a tedious job sometimes, but it's something that we need to do. Talk about that.
Yeah, I truly believe that in recognizing that our Lord used parables, used agrarian examples with his audience constantly in the gospel. And so in other words, he was using creation, the world around us, as analogies, as foundations for parables for us to learn. That's in many ways what I've done with the book. And so when you look at, like I've used in my book, the idea of farming, there's so many examples there that remind us, as you said, that our spiritual journey takes constant care, constant weeding, constant cultivation, year after year, month after month. And it helped me in my own journey to also face up to, as you mentioned, my failures, just as I fail in my spiritual life. I fail to live up to what I've committed myself to. Over and over and over again, and as I get older, it's almost like the older I get, the more dumber I think I am. But I see it played out in the world around us. But the beauty is, in the world around us, I give one example where I cleared an entire area because I was going to start fresh with that area in my farm, but I got distracted on so many other things that area that I cleared completely regrew with more weeds, with more brambles, more stuff. And that was a personal example. That's our own life. We have ambitions. We want to grow. We start all over again after confession, but then we get distracted with the stuff of our life. And as Jesus said, you remove one demon and seven more can come in. And that happens when you're trying to raise a garden, trying to raise a farm, trying to raise to me, the analogies there, our Lord calls us to look to the birds, he says. Well, what does he mean? Well, he says, look at the examples God gives us in his second book of creation to help see the way he tries to guide us in our lives.
I love your last chapter. We're speaking with Marcus Grodi. His book is called Life from Our Land, just put out by Ignatius Press. This is The Search for a Simpler Life in a Complex World. Your chapter on Y2K 15 years later and your list of suggestions. Talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah, I did include that chapter because I, back in 1998, 99, I did help write a book about preparing for Y2K, and I remember that time most of us have forgotten, and I think we missed the point of that. That back in 98, 1999, when we were all wondering whether when our computers turned the dates from 99 to 00, whether the whole world would crumble. And the point that I think the Lord was trying to teach us back then, very much trying to reach us, to see how vulnerable our lives are. And we put so much faith in industry, technology, in our financial advisors, in our politicians, in all of this. And we were given a glimpse in 1999 on how this whole thing could potentially crumble for some very stupid little minute reason. But we didn't learn anything, because here we are 15 years later, and we're more encumbered. We're more attached in our economy. Our world is even more frail than it was 15 years ago. But did we learn anything? And what I try to talk about in the book is how I believe as a culture, as families, that we've blindly become more and more and more encumbered with stuff, our dependence on our investments, and we've ended up being very afraid. We put our families in jeopardy. And I'm not talking apocalyptically here, like the world might crumble in 5, 10, 15, 20 years, but the reality is that there are many people, very well educated and informed folk, that are saying that our economy could very well go through crisis soon. Look at our politics right now. Look at what's happening in the Beltway in D.C. Look at the enemies that we have around the world that are slowly getting closer to our borders all the time. The point is, do we all get bomb shelters and store up food for a year and have lots of guns, or do we look at how can we make sure that we are as unattached to all this stuff so that our families can, the main thing is to survive spiritually. Where are we growing spiritually in the midst of all this? And how free have we become from the stress that all of this brings on to our family? As I try and describe the book, I find it difficult, because you almost need to experience the book in a way. In the same way that I found it hard to write the book because it was such a personal experience, it's also sometimes hard to explain it.
Well, I think it's a lot of different books wrapped into one. I mean, it's almost the Aquinas version of the proofs for God and creation. It's also a book on a spiritual primer on prayer. It's a spiritual book on reflection. And there's many analogies of faith in it. There's many different ways you could describe it, which is probably why you are hesitating to give it one genre. But I think the overreaching point that you have in this book, and, it really is not, you're not to be put off by this if you're not thinking, oh, I'm not a country folk and I don't want to really read about farming. What this book really does, I believe, is it allows you to understand God's nature and his relationship, his seeking you out, and how you need, like they did in Exodus, to come out from whatever Egypt you have and seek him in the quiet and solitude of that desert experience, and then to know him and fall in love with him.
Yeah, the idea of the book is not to belittle a person's desire for a career, a desire to provide well for their family, a desire desire to use your gifts. That's not the point of this book. If anything, I want people, when they look at the gifts they've been given for productivity, to see it as a gift, to be grateful for that, and then to recognize how, through their work, they are giving glory to God and providing for their families in a way that God has given them. The danger is that the goal, the end for so many people today is wealth. The end is accumulation of stuff to the point where they become so attached to accumulation of stuff and wealth, often for fear of the future. I got to have this. I need to have this. I want to have this. That they get on a conveyor belt of having to provide for this more stuff. I mean, we're in a world today where, think about it, when you take any of our electronics, where our electronics require constant input of money because you have to have subscriptions and upgrading and syncing, and then I have to protect myself because now I'm on the Internet and someone could steal my data in a way that 20 years ago we never dreamed this would happen. Our world is moving so fast. And so it's almost like an addiction. Once I have the stuff, I have to have more stuff. And now if I have this stuff, I have to keep having more of a job for money to provide more to, you know, the foundation to having this stuff. And for me, in this book, I was being confronted with the fact of what kind of a model am I leaving for my children and my grandchildren? What kind of a world are we? And how can we make sure that we provide not only a better world, but a better example of how to live our lives? And that's what I found in my experiences. I need to grow in simplicity. Not only for myself, but for the model I leave my kids. And I'm seeing in my kids how I have taught them to run after stuff, to fill your lives with stuff. And I taught them. And so how can I, in my own life, grow in simplicity so that in the end, when I'm 80 years old and I need somebody to take care of me, they aren't overburdened because I've got so much stuff. I want to be not a burden on my children. I want to be a blessing. And I believe that calls us to be simpler, more detached, more focused on God as a giver and a lover, and not merely providing us with stuff.
Talk a little, just as we close, a little bit about the idea of the present moment and being aware of that moment.
And that is so key because when we're in a world in which we have so many responsibilities, and the responsibilities keep increasing, and the more we're caught up in the drive to provide, accumulate, that we miss the moment because we're always focused on our responsibilities or demands. And I'm certainly not the first one, by no means, who has been calling us to slow down, to appreciate the moment. The great spiritual writers have always said that, hey, yesterday's gone. We don't know what's happening tomorrow. The one thing we know is right now. And in this moment right now, are we grateful to God for the gift of this moment and the people he's placed in our lives and the opportunities for us to share God's love with them? What's more important than that? What's more important than that? I can't think of anything. And I believe when it's all said and done, and face our Maker at the end of life, the bottom line is how we love. How have we loved? And if anything, the whole book is about me saying, mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. I have failed so much for it. If there's one thing I can do for the rest of my life, I want to be a better husband and a better father. That's the one thing I want to do. And I hope maybe with this book, I've encouraged somebody else.
Well, I'm going to encourage our listeners to pick it up. It's called Life from Our Land. It's written by Marcus Groda. You know him as the head of the Coming Home Network. And the subtitle is The Search for a Simpler Life in a Complex World. It's available from Ignatius Press. I think it's one of those books that you can just read a chapter from a morning if you're looking to do spiritual reading, or if you want to take it as a retreat, maybe just get away for a weekend if you can. Take the book with you and just ponder and open a chapter and start pondering some of the things that Marcus has so generously thought about and is bringing to us through his reflections. So thank you so much, Marcus, for your time this morning.
Oh, well, thank you very much for this opportunity, and I appreciate your kind words for the book. And God bless you. Thank you.
Well, thank you for writing it.
Bye. Thank you.
And we'll be back right after the station identification. You are listening to Holy Spirit Radio, 1570 AM in Doylestown and 1420 AM in Coatesville and Chester County.
We would understand.
Good morning. This morning we're joined by Robert Royal. He is the author of a new book called The Deeper Vision, The Catholic Intellectual Tradition in the 20th Century. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
Well, I must say this is a magnum opus. If anybody was given this assignment to do this book, writing about the Catholic intellectual tradition in the 20th century, they'd probably want about 10 years and a lot of cups of coffee. My first question is, how long did it take you to write this, and why did you write it?
Well, you know, in a way, I've been writing this my whole adult life. But in terms of real writing, it took about 3 or 4 years. It was done maybe about a year ago. And the reason I undertook this is because I think we really need, in the church at this moment, to understand the riches that we have. That, you know, the Catholic Church is a church that doesn't believe in faith alone, sola fide, as the Protestants say. We believe in faith and reason. That was one of the great emphases of the papacy of John Paul II, and of course Benedict XVI as well. So what I tried to do, and this is very synthetic and it's very readable, I hope, is to give readers a kind of a general line of how rich, actually, our Catholic tradition was in the century just past, and a little bit here into the 21st century as well, because, as we know, there's a lot of hunger out there to know what the Church teaches. And the Church has some very rich cultural concepts that can help us at this moment, not only in Catholic history, but in world history.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, most Catholics probably aren't aware of the philosophical movements that have happened through, the Middle Ages and the Enlightenment. So we're going to talk a little bit about Thomas Aquinas and the idea that he was sort of the apex in terms of the classical scholasticism. And then going into the Enlightenment, you know, you had relativism and you had romanticism. And then what happened? We had this sort of, as we entered into the 20th century, you talk about Jacques Maritain and the revival of St. Thomas Aquinas. Just give us a brief overview for our listeners who are not really familiar with the philosophical tradition of the Catholic Church.
Well, I would say it actually begins with Pope Leo XIII, the great inaugurator of the modern Catholic tradition, the social doctrine, as it's called. But before Leo started that with Rerum Novarum in 1891, he called for a renewal of Thomistic teaching. He himself had been a student of philosophy. And called for not just to be a recovery in the sense of kind of antiquarianism, or looking back to a prior age, but a really creative appropriation of this wisdom of St. Thomas, which also goes all the way back to ancient. So Jacques Maritain was a French philosopher, probably the most influential Catholic philosopher of the 20th century. And Maritain wrote on everything from strict philosophy to mysticism to art, poetry, to political philosophy. He was really one of the great creative genius of the 20th century, but now largely forgotten. In addition to that, he was the inspiration behind the whole creation of the political parties, which were called Christian Democratic, because he wanted a Christian and Catholic alternative to the usual Democratic Party. In other words, something that really had an inspiration with a profound understanding of the human person that comes out of Catholic. And also, he was one of the founders and writers of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the UN. So he's involved in so much, not only at an intellectual level, but also at a public level, that you could probably say there is no one that's been a greater exponent and just tremendously prolific in what he was able to produce in the course of his life. A truly great genius that we really need to talk about.
In preceding him, I mean, we had all these different Enlightenment ideas rationalism and the idea that, you know, I think, therefore I am. He was despairing of that. What was it in this progress that we had in such an emphasis on reason, not to the exclusion of faith, but certainly an overemphasis on reason? What was it that was left for someone who was just a thinking person to think about? I mean, you write a beautiful quote about him saying, if this is all there is, let's just kill ourselves.
Yeah, I begin the book with an anecdote. He and his wife. His wife was a convert from Judaism. Her family came from Russia, and they met. They both met when they were students at the Sorbonne, at the University of Paris, and they were students of science. And what they realized at a certain point was that if that materialist, you called it rationalist also, you can call it that, that materialist rationalist sort of reductive view of the world and of human person just as an animal under that vision. If that were true, there was nothing really worth living for. So they engaged in a mutual suicide pact. If they couldn't find something greater to live for, then divine providence kind of intervened. They met French novelist Léon Blois. They met Charles Péguy, one of the great Catholic geniuses of the 20th century. They met Henri Bergson, and they gradually worked their way into Catholicism. They were baptized. But then Jacques moved into a great appreciation of St. Thomas and Aristotle. And those are the true great, the real rationalism, the rationalism that allows for the fact that the human person has a divine element, that the human soul transcends the body, that we have evidences even with what we see in ourselves and the world around us. There's something more to human life than the materialist scientific vision with which we're all familiar because we're all encompassed by. And it was that opening out of transcendence and an understanding of a rational way to argue about that transcendence that was the great Thomas revival in the first two-thirds of the 20th century. It wasn't only them. It was also Hickson, Joseph Pieper. And in a way, as we can now see, 21st century, even some of the people who opposed some of the what are called the members of what's called La Nouvelle Théologie, the New Theology, were really Thomas working in a slightly different way than the way that the strict scholastics were working. But they too were seeking to recover this tradition of reason that had a broader vision, deeper vision, as I call it, title. And that while not losing what reason can bring us, open us up to an entirely different.
Was there also a need to look at man as he is, as a flawed, concupiscent person, and the need for virtue? And I'm going to go into Alistair MacIntyre on that one.
Yeah, I mentioned there are two chapters about philosophy, and MacIntyre is sort of the figure that I most see us coming out with at the end of the 20th century period, because MacIntyre, too, was a convert, first, been teaching at Notre Dame now for a number of years, and kind of noticed that traditions can go into crisis. This is the great argument in the book, After Virtue. They go into crisis, and then what we have are pieces of tradition. He sees the piecemeal, irresolvable nature of a lot of things in the modern world. Reflecting the fact that we've lost contact with a larger tradition that gave each of those place, and there each of those things have greater meaning. We can look at science and say, yes, there's a place for it. We can look at rational philosophy and say, yes, there's a place for that. But there's also the question that Aristotle didn't confront, that's the one you just mentioned, of human beings as fallen, and therefore in need of something larger beyond themselves. MacIntyre, in his philosophical writing, tends to look at how the crisis of philosophy and rationalism can be solved by a kind of renewed Thomism, Aristotelianism. But he goes beyond that, too. And I think his book on Edith Stein in particular recognizes a kind of a mystical dimension that exists in Catholicism that really speaks to the nature of our soul. So we know that those of us who are Catholic and probably Christians more generally recognize that we can't save ourselves, that even with the best, there's something wounded, there's something broken in the person. Even reason itself is somewhat weakened. wounded. So he points to a way out that I think is very rich, and it's sort of a culmination of this whole period of philosophy and also theology. It gives us the classic Christian vision, you know, this new, very fertile form.
We're speaking with Robert Royal. He's the author of a book called A Deeper Vision, The Catholic Intellectual Tradition in the 20th Century. And you mentioned Edith Stein, and I'm so glad that you included her. She was such a great woman philosopher and a great role model for a lot of Catholic women as well. Her writings on women were greatly influential for John Paul II and her studies of phenomenology. She studied with Husserl, who was the founder of that movement. Talk a little bit about her and her influence on John Paul II.
Yeah, I think she is a great and a great figure, and one who will come to be appreciated more as time goes on. You're right. She was the research assistant for Husserl, and phenomenology is one of those things some of us who do public development joke. It's a name you shouldn't mention in public because it sounds so Germanic and forbidding. And actually, it is in many ways, it's a very simple intuition. She helped Husserl to assemble his very disorderly papers in a kind of an orderly presentation of a number of his books. Essentially, the insight here is that when we go back to a figure like Descartes, I think therefore it sets up this separation of human soul and human mind from the world. Husserl, at his best, at least, she worried a bit, Edith Stein worried a bit about his falling back in that kind of philosophy. At his best, he recognized that this is a false definition. That in point of fact, the world is by its nature something that discloses itself to us. And we human beings who have minds, wills, souls, we are the type of being capable of receiving this disclosure of the world. So in other words, there's a relationship. There's an unbreakable relationship that exists. Even prior to our reflection, we're born into the world, we receive impressions from the world, we learn knowledge from our parents and the other people around us, we learn language. And therefore, there's a different starting place for philosophy than existed for about 300 years of Descartes. This solves one of the great modern problems of skepticism. How can we know about the external world? And beyond that, Edith Stein, I think, had a great sensitivity to things like empathy. One of the reasons she converted was she saw one of her fellow students, Adolf Reinach, was killed in World War I, and she was amazed by the way her Christian family was actually consoling those who were going to console them. And they actually had great confidence that although he had died nobly, and that he was in the hands of God. Therefore, there was a certain confidence and calmness. But there are also many other ways that she notes, the way we sympathize with people. She notes that existentialism, for example, doesn't have to be terrified in the face of the world, that actually most of us have a certain kind of resting in God or resting in creation, and that this is a much overlooked element in modern philosophy, which is very much in love with darkness and trouble and angst and ultimate. She notices many other
things. She also,
I think she's just an astonishing woman. We've still got a lot yet left to learn.
Well, and she also speaks to the idea of gender, and in the days of gender confusion, or the sense that we can choose our gender, it's not determinate at birth. I think she speaks eloquently in terms of that issue, in terms of the differences between men and women and the beauty of the genius of woman. I think that was a large part of why she influenced John Paul II in terms of writing that feminine genius.
Yeah, I mean, she certainly brings to philosophy something that I don't think is available in a great men Catholic philosophy of the 20th century. John Paul had himself great sensitivity to the relationships of men and women, that the wonderful development of the theology of the body that he gave to him. Combined with his studies of phenomenology and a figure like Edith Stein, really recovers for us the sense that our human bodies, which we tend to neglect when we're doing science and when we're doing philosophy, our human bodies, which are gendered as male and female, also tell us something. And those of us who reflect on our genderedness as male and female, going all the way back to Genesis, God makes in the image of, makes us an image and likeness of God. Male and female, he kind of creates. So there's something here that has the spark of the divine that we tend to divorce from our genders, but is intimately, going all the way back to the first page of the Bible, should intimately speak to us. I think John Paul learned that from phenomenology. It was a brilliant expository.
And Mr. Rowley, did you look at the current philosophers like Fabrice Hajjaj, and are they following in those footsteps with regards to their own take on in really trying to deal with and grappling with the issues that we're facing today, such as same-sex marriage and the idea that we can choose a gender?
I have to say, I have to be very disciplined, towards, as is with the book, with Index, something like 621 pages.
Exactly.
I have to deal with just
you've done a great job.
Major figures.
Yeah.
You know, people keep saying to me, why don't you include Stone? Well, if I wanted to do a 30-volume study.
No, of course.
But I wanted this to be a kind of a guide to the average intelligent Catholic interested in what the Church created culturally in the course of the 20th century. One of the things that I do that some people are surprised at in the book is I deal with culture. As John Paul II was the Pope who really recognized that culture is a protagonist in the modern world in a way that it hadn't been earlier. Culture includes things like marriage and family. It includes Catholic literature, history. I have several large chapters about Catholic writers.
Yeah, I love that. I was going to go into that. Yeah,
that you probably read. And I think that the writers and cultural figures and painters and musicians are important because in an age like ours, where human rationality is often devalued, at least in terms of philosophy, we're kind of rational with philosophy. With a science, we don't understand what science is. That imagery and cultural currents are very important in shaping the way we think and feel about the world. So, therefore, those cultural currents have to be, I think, included in our contemporary understanding of the Catholic intellectual tradition. I don't deal with more contemporary currents very much. Things like gender, ideology, same-sex marriage, which really weren't all that prominent in the 20th century, where I have focused.
But I do think the book underscores the fact that God does raise up people of their times to grapple with the issues that they face within their own cultures. And I do think that that's eminently clear in this book. And you mentioned the writers Hilaire Belloc, G.K. Chesterton. And I don't want listeners to think this is a really dry book. It is very readable, and it's very funny. I mean, some of the anecdotes, I love the anecdote you told about Hilaire Belloc kneeling at Westminster Cathedral. You can just see him, you know, and the things that you've chosen to include in this. So it's not a book that's really only for the erudite of heart. You can really read it and really enjoy it, especially those chapters on the great writers, the Catholic writers.
Well, I'm glad you saw that, because I really spent a lot of time trying to make this a readable narrative, because it's simply the nature of the case that we have to understand that there are people who are doing this, that there are people who are called. Jacques Maritain, as I said, responded to that call of Leo XIII. Be very creative, and others responded in different ways to the call of what our time demanded of us as Catholics. And so I tried to include that personal element so that we see these thinkers not just as sort of abstract ideas, but really as embedded in their time. And I think we should take away from that a great deal of confidence and inspiration ourselves, because those figures didn't have all the answers ahead of time. They had to work through these problems. Maritain, for example, had to confront the terrible scourge of ideology in the 20th century, which is one of the reasons why he develop a Christian nation. You had to combat communism with its gulag, and fascism, and Nazism, labor camps, and Auschwitz. So there are practical consequences of understanding who God is, and who the human person is because of God. And I think going forward we should have great confidence in our tradition, which we need to recover. That's one of the reasons why I wrote this. But our tradition is the richest cultural tradition, continuous cultural tradition in the world. And there are resources in it that we can mine even today for problems that are somewhat different than they were just 20 months ago.
Yeah, we should also mention that you do deal with Vatican II.
Yes.
And what happened preceding it and what its effects were. And I says we're still unraveling that, I would imagine.
Yeah, I call those chapters the critical interview. I mean critical and ambivalent. I'm a bit critical of what came out of the council, although I think that the documents themselves could be read in different ways than they were. But it was also a critical moment, and the one of the difficulties we have to deal with is that even outside of the Catholic world, the first two-thirds of the 20th century are much richer culturally than the last one after the 1960s. Global culture in general tends to take a nosedive and go to a much lower level. Put this in secular terms. There are great musicians like Igor Stravinsky and painters like Pablo Picasso and writers like James Joyce and Marcel Proust at the beginning of the 20th century. There's no one in the secular world at that same level last two-thirds of the 20th century. So this is not unknown in history. There are periods that are more fertile, sterile, and we entered a kind of a cultural wasteland, I think it's not too strong to say, about 1970. In the Catholic Church, with the exception, I think, of Carol Wojtyla, John Paul II, and Joseph Ratzinger, were two of the great geniuses of the last 20th century. We've got to deal with that as well. We just have to recognize that the cultural world outside of us is not richer than inside. The cultural world outside of us is noticeably lower, at a lower level than it was 100 years ago. So we have a dual challenge. We have a dual challenge to recover our own tradition, but to also recognize that we have a lot to say to a world that is bereft of even what a lot of the best secular parts of culture were able to provide.
I guess the question I would ask is, are we saying it, and is it up to the lay people to say it?
Well, look, it's such a vast task that lay people, clerics, bishops, all have a role to play. One of the images that I often turn to now, although the book was largely written before Pope Francis was elected, is Pope Francis has put this image out there of the church as a field. The world is a mess, fallen world. We see it in terms of terrorism, warfare, the decline of the family, human trafficking. I mean, there's just all this mess out there in the world. As Chesterton once said, that the world provides us with the most obvious empirical confirmation of the fall. You can see that the human rights is falling. But when Francis talks about the church as being a field hospital, therefore having to deal with this situation, world, I think that we have to understand that in the right way. And the right way to understand it is to recognize that the church is sort of in the same position as a doctor. If a doctor comes to your bedside and has no medical knowledge, he may have a good bedside manner, and reassuringly to you, and you get an emotional high from that. You get consoled. But if the doctor doesn't have the medical knowledge to cure you, well, then he isn't a very good doctor. The same is true of the church. The church as a field hospital doesn't have that solid formation in terms of philosophy, knowledge, scripture, culture, art, the arts, etc. If it doesn't have that human richness, then it can't really cure what the problem is in a time like ours. So we all have a responsibility. I think lay people in particular, which is one of the reasons why I wrote that book that way. I didn't write it for specialists. I didn't write it for philosophers or scripture scholars. I wrote it for lay people because I think lay people need to step forward those of us who care about the church read a book like this, be inspired in whatever way that your circumstances permit, inspire you to bring that richness, that confidence, that faith into every nook and cranny of the world that we're living in.
And just in terms of epical ages, my sense is that even in the pagan times, there was at least a sense of morality. You know, there was a sense of virtue and the importance of that. Have we come to an age where it's sort of unprecedented in world history in terms of just an amoralistic view, individualistic relativism, secularism? We have the highest rate of single parent births in the history of the world, and this idea that, you know, the slaughter of innocent babies is okay, and the lack of respect for human life, the taking of human life. I think it's unprecedented in the history of the world.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
In terms of what sometimes is called personal morality, it's kind of an absurd term, all morality has a public dimension. I think that it's true that a kind of skepticism of relativism has just become radical. And so it's impossible to say, you quote the idea of out-of-wedlock birth, in any previous society, it was thought utterly disastrous when out-of-wedlock births got to about 10-12%, but typically they were about 5-6%. We have, in the United States right now, about 40% of children born out-of-wedlock. For American African, for African-Americans, it's something like 80%.
Yeah.
This is a disaster situation, and I think the church needs to talk more more shrewdly, that this is not simply some abstract moral argument that we're making, that we're not repressed sexually. This has real-world consequences that can be demonstrated by sociologists, political scientists, cultural commentators. Now, the irony, though, is that at the same time that we have this utterly radically individualistic morality in terms of sexuality, marriage, family, we're very puritanical on a variety of other things.
Yeah, that's true.
In terms of smoking, food, environmentalism, there's a kind of an authoritarian. So it's quite odd. You know, we've abandoned one of the places where those other elements could have been introduced in a more humane way within the family, which is always going to be the school. The church always teaches that the family is the primary element of society, not the individual. The individual is kind of a Cartesian fiction. None of us could even learn how to speak without being born into families. There are stories, I don't remember if I do this in the book or not, I probably don't, but there are stories about what are called wild children, children who were abandoned by their families or get lost out in the jungle, and they were found many years later, they survived because apes or something took care of them. They can never learn to speak yet. Because they did not go through their brains didn't go through the developmental process that we all go through in our family, learning language, learning how to be socialized. Family is utterly crucially important to the health of any society, and no human being can exist without it. So it's an oddity that we put ourselves into this self-destructive mode, that all the other things we try to do to make our lives better in terms of environment, health, you know, these large public questions are being undermined by the fact that we don't take care of marriage and family.
Mm.
The terrible decline in birth rate in Europe, which is going to lead to the extinction of every place from Britain out to the eastern reaches of Russia, this too is a very clear consequence of what God's original intention was. Ethics of marriage and family—it's a disaster, and I think we're going to see it more acute very shortly in the next few years.
But the confidence we have with your book is that God will raise someone up, and He always does. And where sin abounds, grace abounds all the more. And that's, I think, the purpose behind this book: that God has left His church and His bride as the way out to lead people back to Him. Again, we're speaking with Robert Royal. The book is called A Deeper Vision, The Catholic Intellectual Tradition in the 20th Century. It is a wide-ranging book from philosophy to arts and literature, and written by someone who has studied so many greats. And Robert, we have to ask, is your book on Dante going to come back into print anytime soon?
I thought it had been issued in a new edition, but I hope that it comes out again. That, too, is a little book. I've been an aficionado of Dante for almost 50 years, going back to my teenage days. And, that little book, too, is written not for specialists, but it's written for an average reader who wants to get a sense. Because Dante is hard, as a lot of great writers are. Dante is very hard because Divine Comedy is a total vision of the world as Dante knew it in the High Middle Ages. So to understand any part of it, you've got to kind of understand the overall arc of what Dante was up to. And so I tried in that book, which was part of a series, the format of it was kind of imposed on me, but I have a very long introduction that explains Dante. And then what you do is you have excerpts from the writer with commentary. So I hope that that book, I'm going to check back with the publisher, actually, now that you've mentioned it. I'd like to have that book back in print. I think it's a very helpful book. At least many people who are friends of mine have told me that. Well, he's just one example. And, you know, in the Middle Ages, you talk about renewal. We think that St. Francis and St. Dominic founded the Franciscans and the Dominicans at a time that was favorable. Actually, it was quite the contrary. St. Dominic was responding to the Cathars and the Gnostic heresies in Spain of his day. St. Francis was looking for renewal of the church in Italy of his day. So it's these crises which tend to draw out the utter heroism and holiness that need to be joined together for any great renewal or renaissance of the church to take place. And it's happened again and again, as you rightly said. So I think we can have confidence that God won't fail us.
Where can our listeners find you if they want to find out more about you or any of your works? You have the Catholic Thing blog, right?
Right. The Catholic Thing is the daily column series. I don't write every day. I'm the general editor, and I write usually once or twice every 2 weeks. That's www.thecatholicthing.org. They can also look at the website of my Faith and Reason Institute, which is www.frinstitute.org.
Okay, and are you still teaching the classes on Dante? Can they do that online as well?
We'll be starting those again in January. This is a real-time online presentation of Dante via what's called Libertas University. And we take, we take 6 or 7 weeks to go through Inferno, same amount of time through Purgatorio, same amount of time through the Paradiso. So if anyone is interested in taking those courses, they can contact me via the Catholic Thing or via Faith and Reason Institute. We're going to start advertising those very soon. So they're very interesting courses, and because of the kind of technology that we now have, we usually meet on Wednesday evening after work or after school, and we spend 2 hours, together reading and talking about the text. And I try to bring experience that I've had reading Dante over several decades to help explain them.
And point out to listeners that if it is interactive, it's not just like taking an online course that's already been pre-recorded and taped. They actually can interact with the group, right?
No, we sit around a virtual, very fascinating. Our avatars sit around a seminar table, just like you would in a classroom.
That's pretty cool.
We talk with them.
Yeah.
Start to read the text together. We bounce off one another and bring up points. It's quite remarkable. It's about as close as you can get to going to an actual seminar on Dante without having to leave your house.
Okay, we've been speaking with Robert Royal. Book again, A Deeper Vision, The Catholic Intellectual Tradition in the 20th Century, available from Ignatius Press. We thank you so much for your time this morning.
Well, thank you very much.